Our souls are restless till we find our home in Thee. The words were from St. Augustine 1,600 years ago. Our souls are restless till we find our home in Thee. We gather here from many places and we bring many needs. Joy, sadness, depression, energy, and optimism. All those feelings and more are present here today. Perhaps it's at least true to say that our souls are restless until we find our home somewhere in something that's adequate to our yearnings. It is good to be together again to become absorbed in these abiding yearnings. It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Once in a land far away where no one cared. Yes. There was a man who went out one night in a land he didn't know his way around. It was very dark. There was no moon, and it was foggy. And he couldn't see a thing. And he walked and walked and walked and walked, wondering what awful things might happen to him, until finally he fell off a cliff. And as he turned, as he was falling, he turned around quickly and grabbed the edge of the cliff with his fingers, of both hands, because he wasn't holding a microphone. And he held on to the cliff. He had no idea how many miles down it was that he was going to fall and crash. And he yelled for people, but there was no one around. He didn't know anyone there. It was too dark to see anything anyway. So he held on and he tried to figure out how to pull himself back up on the cliff. He was just terrified that he was going to fall. And he held on and held on until finally he realized he simply can't hold on any longer. That he has to let go of the only thing he's got left here to hold on to, and he's going to fall. And slowly his fingers slipped off the edge of the cliff until he had let go and he fell. 6 inches to the ground that had been there all the time. Sometimes our fears are a lot worse than things really are. And that's the end of the story. For our centering, I brought a psalm written by a poet who lived under the gaze of God. This is taken from Psalm 90. Lord, you have been our refuge forever. Before the mountains were born, before the earth and the world came to birth, from eternity to eternity, you have been our God. You bring human beings to dust by saying, return, children of the earth. 1,000 years are to you like a yesterday which has passed, or like a watch in the night. In the morning we're growing grass, in the morning we're blossoming, by evening we're withered and dry. You've seen our guilty deeds, our secrets are open to your eyes. So teach us to number our days, that we might come to the heart of wisdom. Let your favor be upon us, and establish the work of our hands upon us, yea, the work of our hands. Establish thou it. Amen. The hymn is about living under the gaze of those who aren't here. And in a small way, it's also an example of it, because that hymn was written by a former minister of this church, Fred Wooden, who served it a decade ago and wrote the hymn while he was here. I first heard this odd phrase, living under the gaze of eternity, when I was in graduate school. It comes from a Latin phrase about living sub specie eternitas, which was usually translated living under the aspect of eternity, and I had absolutely no idea what that meant. Until finally a professor said that it would make more sense to translate it as living under the gaze of eternity. Frankly, the idea wasn't attractive. It felt like divine peeping toms just sort of lurking about that gazing business. And I didn't like it. We were taught it as a phrase that Romans used to say this was how noble people should live. To learn how to live as noble people, you should live under the gaze of eternity. But I didn't like the idea. I never liked the idea that God was watching either. And even as a child, in the first incarnation of this idea, I never liked the idea that Santa Claus was watching. I still remember that terrifying, threatening children's song. He knows when you are sleeping. He knows when you are awake. He knows if you've been bad or good. So be good, for goodness sake. I didn't like it. I wanted to deny him access to some of that knowledge. I was talking with Karen after the first service, and she said that when she was a child, she had some of the same fears, but she assumed that it was Santa's elves who were the evil little spies that were just lurking everywhere watching you. It's an odd idea, being watched by strangers. I'm sure I'm not the only one who's had trouble taking that idea very, very seriously. My first memorable experience of feeling like I was under the gaze of someone I didn't know was watching came in the eighth grade. It was not a positive experience. Each year, I lived in Colfax, Iowa, a town of 1,800 people, about 20 miles from Des Moines. It's probably like every other town of about that size everywhere in the world. And each year, the Girl Scouts in Colfax sponsored a Sadie Hawkins Day dance. This goes back a ways, but it was a dance named after an assertive character from the Little Abner cartoon strip, a woman who asked men for dates to dance, and when asked, you had to go. So they had the Sadie Hawkins Day dance when I was in eighth grade, as they had it every year, on a Saturday night. I hoped and I prayed that I would be spared. But Helen Van Elsen asked me to the Sadie Hawkins Day dance, and I had to go. Now, don't get me wrong, Helen was a lovely girl, but I was 14, and I didn't have a clue about anything. There are some problems staging a dance like this for eighth graders in Colfax, Iowa, all those many years ago. One was that no one knew how to dance. Another was that the girls at 14 had no idea how to communicate with the boys, and the boys had hardly any idea how to communicate with anyone. The dance went on the way it would in a B movie about a town this size with a dance just like this. The girls sat in chairs on one side of the room. The boys sat in chairs on the other side of the room. The music played, and every once in a while, a couple girls would get up and dance with each other because the boys were just useless. After this dance came to its merciful end, Helen and I walked downtown to the Rexall drugstore, where we sat and drank chocolate Cokes and cherry Cokes and talked and talked and talked. We didn't watch the time and weren't aware of it until the owner of the drugstore came up to tell us that we would have to leave because he was closing. It was midnight. It was a little later than we'd planned on, so I walked Helen home and then walked to my house. Now, Monday morning in eighth grade in Colfax, English class was always first, but on this next Monday morning, the English teacher came into class on a mission. She glared at me from the minute she entered the room. stomped over to the desk, dropped her books and papers and other paraphernalia, pointed right at me, said, "What do you mean getting Helen Nelson home at 12:17 Sunday morning?" And I thought, I got to get out of this town. This is way too much. So I'd been watched. I had no idea from where or by whom, but they were obviously looking at their clock while they were watching and taking notes. I didn't like it. Another memorable experience was much later. It happened about a dozen years ago. I was a minister in Kalamazoo, Michigan, a town of about 250,000 people. And I was in the grocery store one day. I think it was a Friday, and I was tired. I'd worked all day, and I was tired and hungry, and I wanted to get home, and I had a cart full of stuff. I was standing in line, and I became sort of vaguely aware that some woman was coming up to the line with a cart that only had like two or three things in it. And she didn't say anything. It was just sort of all body language and cart language, you know, and intimidation by grocery cart. But at that deep subliminal cart level, we communicated, and I was just completely absent-minded about it and pulled my cart back without even thinking. She had two or three things, and I had a whole cart full. As soon as I pulled my cart back and she pulled in, I realized what I'd done, and I was real sorry I'd done it, because I was tired and I was hungry and I wanted to go home, and it was my place in line, and I didn't want to give it up. But it was too late. I'd already done it. After she pulled her cart in, she turned around and looked at me, and she said, "Thank you. It's nice to see that some preachers practice what they preach." If only she knew how close I was. I had no idea who this woman was. She did not come to my church. But I had a weekly television show in town, and so I was seen by all kinds of unknown people at all kinds of unknown times, and never had any idea whether the person next to me in the grocery store was someone who'd actually been watching and listening and was now watching me to see if I practiced what I preached. I didn't like it. I think that we're living in such a time of individualism and unfettered individualism that the whole idea of being responsible to the gazes of unseen others that we didn't choose to gaze on us is foreign, if not unappealing. Of course, it doesn't have to be negative. The idea can be positive. But to me, it was negative. And I think those experiences probably go a long way to explain why I use a Macintosh computer. Just checking to see if you're awake. It's the only one I've ever used. I'm on my fourth one. Some of you will remember the television ad that first introduced these computers. It's one of the classic ads in TV history. It came at the halftime of the Super Bowl in 1985. And at the time, the only real competition was IBM. And so IBM was portrayed in this powerful ad as a kind of totalitarian big brother who was up on a screen watching everyone and expecting everyone to conform and to do it his way. It was a wonderful ad. And then this heroic savior figure came out with a hammer, a big hammer, and threw the hammer through the air in slow motion, and it shattered the screen with Big Brother on it. Then there's this quirky little Macintosh computer with a line drawing squigglies and saying, "Hi." I bought one a couple months later. I don't mind them talking to me, but I don't want them watching me. For a lot of people, the notion of being watched by others or checking in like that is a lot more positive. I think one of the most popular, and this is, I think this is more pop culture than it is pop religion, but it's pop, is the habit so many young people have had for a number of years now of getting bracelets that say WWJD on them. What would Jesus do? And this is a very positive thing. And the notion is that when they're stuck somewhere, I mean, they aren't asking themselves this all the time, but when they're stuck with a tough decision, then the bracelet reminds them to back off and stop and say, all right, wait a minute. What would Jesus do here? And then the idea is that they might find the courage to do what they think Jesus would do there. It's not bad. I have a colleague for whom Jesus wasn't a very important figure, but she liked the idea. And so she had a bracelet made that said, and it looked just like the others, that said WWXD. She wanted to know, what would Zena do? And I thought this was just kind of a quick joke until I talked to her and realized she's watched all the Zena episodes. She knows them cold. I mean, this woman is a heroic figure to her. And asking what would Jesus do or what would Zena do is a way of saying, what would someone who had absolute courage do here? What would somebody who knew what was right and didn't have to care what anybody thought and would only do what was right, what would they do here? I think it's what kids do. I'm not sure they use Santa Claus very much for it. Maybe 2 weeks before Christmas, kids try to fake being good so that Santa might watch. But I'm not sure that in June or July it's a very big item for them. But I know that it's how kids, and it's certainly how I, used characters like Superman. When I was a boy, my heroic super figures were Superman and Captain Marvel. Clark Kent and Billy Batson. I would sneak off sometimes when I was about six where no one could watch and say, Shazam! 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 And try all the pronunciations I could to see if the lightning would come. Never did. But that wanting to become like a Captain Marvel or a Superman was, and I think I was almost consciously aware of it as a kid. It was when I was in tough spots where I didn't know what to do and I really didn't have the courage to do what I knew was the right thing to do. And I was tempted to go along, and that's when I'd ask, what would Superboy do? What would Clark Kent or Billy Batson or Captain Marvel do? I needed to feel that I was in some kind of a relationship with people of absolute courage and absolute character. People who knew what was right and who would do what was right, no matter what anyone thought about it. Besides my two negative experiences with being gazed upon, I did have one very positive and very powerful experience of feeling gazed upon. It came at what might be an unlikely time. It came during the graduation ceremony when I got my PhD. I don't like graduation ceremonies. And I had been to one in high school because I didn't have any choice. I graduated from a military academy, and that wasn't optional, skipping graduation. But I haven't ever gone to the ceremonies from college or from the master's degree or any of this. I wasn't planning to go to this one either. And a classmate that I'd been with through 7 years of this school said, no, you have to go to this one. And I said, why do I have to go to this thing? And he said, you have to go because you have to hear the one line that the president of the university will say to doctoral students. And he wouldn't tell me what it was. So I was curious enough to rent a gown and a hat and go, and I'm very glad I did. After all the undergraduates, and it wasn't a big school, after all the undergraduates got their degrees and the master's students got their degrees, then Hannah Gray, who was the president of our school, called all the doctoral students up onto the stage. And she made some generic kinds of congratulations for doing good work and so on and so forth, and kind of boilerplate stuff. And then she said this line, which I memorized on the spot and became sacred, powerful words. It's amazing how it can do that. What she said was simply, I welcome you into the ancient and honorable community of scholars. 11 words, that's all. They were worth the whole trip. I welcome you into the ancient and honorable community of scholars. I understood in that instant what it felt like to live under the gaze of eternity. It felt to me, and I know from some others who went through the ceremony, that it felt to them too. This isn't something that we wanted to admit, but it felt like all those scholars we'd been reading were there with us now. We'd crossed over. We were in their club. Plato was there. Aristotle was there. All the philosophers we'd read. St. Augustine was up there. All the great theologians that we've read, all the poets, the philosophers, psychologists, archaeologists, anthropologists, everybody we'd read and struggled with. They weren't foreigners challenging us to pass a course anymore. They were standing there with us. And I felt this absolutely vividly. I felt their gaze and I felt their presence. It was quite something. I still feel their gaze. Every time I work on a sermon, every time I try to write something that's going to the paper or somewhere else, I feel that gaze and I try to put myself back in touch with that imaginary group of people who I know I don't belong with, but Hannah Grace said that we're all in this club, and they're there. And I find that what I'm doing when I do that is the same thing I was doing when I was a six-year-old boy wondering what Superman would do. I'm trying to take what I'm doing seriously in a way that people like that would approve of. That people like that would say, all right, you've done your homework. That's good enough. Do it. It's very powerful. I think one of the lasting benefits of a good education, wherever and however you get it, can be formal or informal education. One of the lasting benefits that isn't talked about enough is the quality of the ghosts that haunt you. It's really empowering to be haunted by a high order of ghost. I think that's also one of the lasting benefits of a good personal religion. The quality of the spirits that become present in your imagination. The quality of the transcendent ideals or values that gaze on us, that hold us in their community, that hold us accountable, and that say, you can do this. You're one of us. We can do it, and you can do it. It helped me get used to the idea of being gazed upon when I realized that, unlike grocery stores, these other eyes aren't always watching. They're an invisible and imaginary community that I can call forth when I want them there. That I can call forth when I'm stuck. When I know what my first reaction is here, but I wonder, what could I be more proud of doing? What could I be most proud of doing? How would the people that I've always respected most in my life, what would they do here? What would Plato or Augustine or Jesus or Zena? What would people who were absolutely not afraid to do the right thing, what would they do here when I'm tempted to be too weak and too afraid? It's like standing among an ancient and honorable community of scholars, of saints, of heroes. And that's the kind of feeling St. Augustine was after, I think, when he said, our souls are restless till we find our home in Thee. My eighth grade my 8th grade English teacher. It was a blessing. What she was representing was a voice in the community saying, there are standards here. There are ways that decent people are expected to treat one another. And we just want to make sure that you know that. She wasn't accusing. She was just making it very clear that there are standards and that being part of a civil society means internalizing them. I don't think we can become fully human without those voices and those eyes. And that anonymous woman in the grocery store was a blessing. She's one of those voices, and they can come anywhere and any time, that remind us that we really do need to practice what we preach, even when we don't feel like it. Because ultimately, people don't judge us by what we say. Our deeds usually drown out our words, and they're busy watching those. That's a blessing. We're living in a funny time. We're living in a society of people who, on the one hand, are the kind of people I see on those horrible Jay Leno jaywalk segments that make me crazy, that don't know what century World War II was fought in or what country the Vietnam War occurred in, or who swear they've never seen Dick Cheney or Colin Powell before in their life when shown a picture of him. We live in a society with a lot of drugs, with a lot of selfishness, with a lot of dishonesty in places both high and low. There's a lot of bad stuff in the world we're living in. But we're also living in an invisible community of poets and saints, heroes and lovers. They are the better angels of our nature. And by keeping them in mind, by learning to grow comfortable under their gaze, these noble souls can become even more. The God we keep in mind becomes our God and sustains us. Or the poets and saints, the heroes and lovers that we keep in mind become our people. We become one of them. They're our people. They're our angels. And they're the home that we have sought so long for our restless souls.